Welcome to this afternoon session of the Boston Book Festival. Boy, this feels pretty powerful up here. I mean, geez, I've always wanted to do this. Gosh, didn't know I'd get this. I'd sign up for this more often. But this is an amazing, amazing session we have this afternoon with three superstar women. We have, obviously, Robin Young over here from WBUR. 90.9, our title sponsor here, with Amy Cuddy from Harvard Business School and Sherry Turkle. So I'm going to let Robin do their introductions. I'm just here to say a few words. My name is Tony Chan. I'm Managing Director and CEO of Cueball Group. We're a venture capital firm here in Boston, and we also operate nail salons called Minilux. But we are here today as a real, real proud sponsor of this session. I've come to know these three women over the course of the past several years, and I can assure you, you are in the best session of the entire day. There are 200 authors here, but these three are the best. And so we do not want any of you leaving. yeah, that would be you back there. Come back. But I just want to say a few words about the Boston Book Festival and why we are so proud to have supported it. Debbie Porter, alongside her colleagues, have really given a gift to this city of Boston. Every single year, through the power of the written word, through the culture of reading, we have a reason to convene some 30,000-odd people to the wonderful Back Bay of Boston for a free public gathering of intellectual capital, of connectivity, of new ideas, of sharing time with one another, and that's why the Boston Book Festival is so great. I hope all of you will consider sponsoring it or helping it in any way you want. I know we have a drawing for a Vespa. It's the last chance. I know you all want a red Vespa. That is on your list. It's an awesome, awesome thing. But I just want to say again, thank you all for coming. You all make this festival wonderful. Thank you, the three of you, for kicking us off on this session, on being present. So Robin Young, I'll let you take it away.
Thank you so much, and thank you. And without sponsors like that, this would not be happening. Okay, first of all, let us pray. I've always wanted to say that, too. I have to say, I'm going to deduct myself, you know, subtract myself from all of those statements that you made, because these are the authors. And I can feel the power coming off these two women. It's already just energized me, and hopefully it will all of us by the end of this session. So let's do some introductions. Amy Cuddy, after a devastating car accident when she was just 19, it took years for her to learn how to live in her body again. And then as a college professor at Harvard, she saw seemingly whole students who didn't seem to have any physical problems unable to do what she had to do through physical therapy, years of physical therapy. They could not be in their own bodies. They were in the room but absent. She gave one of the most popular TED Talks of all time on being present, and the result is the book Presence, Bringing Your Boldest Self to Your Biggest Challenge. And yes, yes, by the end of this session, you will all have starfished up. We're going to do that. Do you know what that is? No. Oh, just wait. And then we have, of course, sociologist and psychologist Sherry Turkle, who's been studying the impact of technology on human relationships for 30 years. And she's now sounding an alarm that we're raising a generation of kids who can't talk to each other. They can't look you in the eye. They think nothing of texting each other while they're sitting next to each other. And so we're going to hear about that. And on that note, everyone, cell phones down. Unless you're going to tweet. And if you are, and I'm telling you, I might, because I'm realizing that like 10 minutes can't go by. I'm criticizing the young people in my life, but 10 minutes can't go by when I'm not feeling like I have to do something with this thing. So
am I going to be helping you with
you that? You are. This is a therapy session. That's what this is. And let's start. So many interactions between you two. And what a fabulous, brilliant pairing, because I was realizing that you both talk about reclaiming power, you reclaiming the power of your body to actually communicate for you. You talk about reclaiming the power of very communication that we've lost. And one of the reasons that we've lost both the physical and the interaction is the cell phone. Just, Amy, just start with you to explain that, because I remember you telling me that part of the physical problems that we're having is that we are over our cell phones.
That's true. I mean, this is, I think, a small part of what's going on with technology, but you know, I do look at the role of posture and how we're perceived by other people, but also how we feel about ourselves. And if we're spending our time hunched over this phone, which is really the posture of someone who's clinically depressed, that's probably not very good for us, given that clinical psychologists know that getting someone who's depressed to sit up straight makes them feel better.
Right.
So we've done a bit of work around just use of technology, and we find that people, after working for 5 minutes on an iPhone versus a desktop, are much less assertive in how they behave. So they do tend to go into a kind of powerless, primitive fight or flight
mode. This is science.
Mode.
This is science.
Yeah. So this is this study is unpublished. There's a follow-up study though that I think is even more interesting done at Purdue, looking at the iPhone and desktop conditions, that finds some physiological changes as well. Just, you know, so basically, when you are hunched over that phone, you are acting like a scared animal. When you're sitting at your desktop, spread out, shoulders back, your hands are here instead of here, you don't see those effects. You're not behaving as if you're about to be attacked by a tiger, right? So our phones clearly take us away from the present because we're looking at them and thinking of the people, you know, who we're connected to through the phone, but also just in this very primitive way, they take us away from the present.
Did everybody just do as I did and sit up a little bit? Because every time I'm with Amy, I feel like such a schlump, you know, and part of it is that I'm tired all the time, but part of it is that I am, you know, looking down. And after I spoke with you, I raised my computer, I raised everything. I got a stand for my phone so that I can work with it when it's when it's higher, and it raised me up a little bit. Sherry, you've been working on this idea of what technology is doing to us, you know, as you said, for 30 years. Your 2011 book was Alone Together. But it feels like exponentially it is so much worse. I'm living now, I just became a mother 3 weeks ago to a 16-year-old. It's insane. But it's my sister's youngest who's come to live with me. And I am so profoundly sad about what I'm seeing exponentially since 6 months ago when I saw him. So talk about some of the things that you're seeing in young people, college people. The rule of three.
Well, the rule of three, just a little bit of background. I've basically been studying what our lack of attention to each other, because we're paying attention to our phones so often, is doing to our empathic connection. And one of the really stunning studies in this regard is that if just Robin and I are sitting at lunch and I put my cell phone face down and turned off. Face down, turned off. Between us, which is kind of what you do if you wanted to be polite to a friend. You take out your phone, you put it face down, you turn it off, and you'd be ready to talk. The very presence of the phone means that two things happen. First thing that happens is that our conversation turns to more trivial matters. Because just the thought of where that phone might take each of us, or where we go with our phone,
or when it's going to buzz,
just that it could, or that it sometimes does, or it's a reminder of the way we live, and we just start to talk about more trivial things. And then the second thing that happens is that we feel less connected to each other. There's less of an empathic connection between the two of us. So it's not surprising, since that. So if you learn, the professor in me is just feeling to make the point that if you take one thing away from this is to just do the simple gesture, that if you're having a meeting or a lunch with a friend, a colleague, a lover, a student, a child, take your phone and put it out of sight instead of just putting it on the table.
It's remarkable.
The simplest gesture.
Okay, but go back to kids. And by the way, this isn't just kids.
Yeah. I mean, that means that where that shows up, and then I'll get to the rule of three just very quickly, where that shows up is that there's been a 40%, in the past 30 years, there's been a 40% decline in all the ways that we know how to measure empathy among college students. And I see this, and this is the rule of three, when I study college students in the dining hall, where they explain to me how they want to text, but they also want to talk to each other, and they observe what they call the rule of three, which would be that if we were six around a table, three of us would have to have our heads up before I would feel not rude to put my head down to text, so that the entire conversation takes place with heads up, heads down, heads up, heads down.
But there's a, is it subconscious that they think, okay, now I can look because
there are three? It becomes self-conscious. It becomes just the new etiquette of digital life today. But the result is the same as the silent, as the phone on the table, which is that conversation becomes more trivial, empathy goes down.
Yeah, and talk about, you had a meeting with, I think, eight kids that you were interviewing, and they were very uncomfortable until they said, you know, could we have our meeting but also do it simultaneously on WhatsApp?
They wanted to do it on WhatsApp. They wanted to essentially meet with me but also be using WhatsApp, you know, have a meeting, a parallel meeting, on it, where they could be texting and sharing things on texting.
It's just astonishing. Amy, what, another thing that I see connecting both of these is self-esteem. You think that everything that we have today would it was supposed to empower us. It's not. I mean, people don't feel good about themselves. People, I mean, your whole thing is find yourself, feel empowered. They don't.
This is, as I'm sure Sherry knows more than I do. I mean, when I tweet something about screen time possibly maybe being bad for us, there's nothing that elicits more backlash that I could tweet about. So I'm very careful when talking about the pros and cons of technology. You know, and can I just ask first, have you experienced that? I mean, do you get backlash when you say technology
like,
might
welcome
not be great
to my
for
world.
Us? Right. So I just want to...
why aren't we just old farts sitting up here saying that? I mean, why isn't that... As who was the late night? Stephen Colbert said to you, aren't just little sips of Twitter, if we have little sips of conversation, doesn't that add up to a one big conversation?
Right. Why do I think we're not? Well, this is, I feel very strongly about this. Mm-hmm. I feel that my message is the future, not the past. I feel very strongly about this, that the message that, my message is not anti-technology. My message is pro-conversation. And there are many, many, I love my phone. I love that all of my tickets, my Acela, my Deltas, it's all on my phone. I mean, how great is that? My taxis and I think that we need to handle the privacy implications of this. I mean, obviously we need more firewalls and privacy, but when we can get that right, I love what the phone brings me. But as the most important thing is to get back to talking to our children, to talking to the people we love, to talking to our colleagues, to talking to the students in our classrooms, and not putting apps in front of their faces. There are baby bouncers that have a slot for an iPad. This is crazy that we're thinking, and potty trainers that have a slot for an iPad. A mother knows that these are times when you need to make eye contact with your child. The child that you don't talk to when they're in a baby bouncer is a child that will not grow up knowing that eye contact is crucial in human relations.
And say that again, that it's not just, it's nicer when we look at each other and
it's
we
crucial.
Feel like, it's crucial to wiring
it's
your
crucial.
Brain to have empathy.
It's crucial. And what these, and the way we're using our devices now is taking us away from really our deeper selves, because it's the way we're living now with constant stimulation is interfering with our capacity, not just for empathy, but for solitude. And the psychoanalytic tradition, which is the tradition I'm steeped in, has a wonderful way of putting it, which is that if you don't teach your children to be alone, they will only know how to be lonely. If you don't have the capacity for solitude, you will not have the capacity to come to other people and really see who they are and hear who they are. You'll always just be projecting who you need them to be in order to sustain your sense of fragility.
Amy, talk about the college students that helped spark your thinking. You noticed that there were some kids that raised their hands.
Yeah, I think, and do you mind if I just
please
follow up a bit on what you were saying? My husband said the other day, he went for a run without his phone or some kind of wearable device, and he said he felt like a revolutionary to do that. And you know, it allowed him to enjoy the run again and to be alone with himself in a way that was really peaceful, and to experience this run through the woods without quantifying it. And because that's another thing that takes us out of the present. I mean, when we're on our phones, we've got all kinds of apps that quantify in these concrete terms what we've just done. Did we succeed or not? As opposed to, it's not quantifying, did you enjoy the process? Do you still love running? It's telling you how fast you ran on this little snippet compared to other people in your part of Newton, and you know, compared to the last week and the next week. It's all about measuring. And I've heard people say that as soon as you start quantifying something, you stop enjoying it. And I think there's something to that. So I think that's another way in which it takes us away from ourselves and really knowing who we are. And if we don't know who we are, then we can't help be present with other people. I mean, one of the things that I really emphasize is that when we are present, when we're bringing our real selves to situations, we're liberating other people to be present. If we're first saying, I'm unafraid to be here with you as myself, you're building trust, and trust is this conduit of influence and exchange, and when that's there, people are less afraid to be themselves with you. So I think back to this, it's about the self and it's about interactions, and this technology is taking us away from both. I think we're going to work it out. Mm-hmm. If I can just say one more thing about why the kind of backlash, I think there are two possibilities, and I'm sure there are others, it's probably overdetermined, but one is that it feels like a moral judgment. So people who are on their phones a lot, when they hear something like, oh, this might not be great for you, they feel morally judged. And it's sort of the same way. There's some research from the 90s on how people feel around vegetarians, and they feel judged by them. Even if the vegetarian's like, I don't care if you eat meat, people feel judged by them. And I think there's some
Sorry.
Of that. But another one is that, to some extent, it's become a collective addiction, and it's, you know, people. There's an old Willie Nelson saying about vodka or something about alcohol that, you know, it doesn't. All of these other things might leave me, but I'll always have the drink. And I think people feel equally sort of protective of their phones and technology, that they really hold on to it. So there's an addictive quality that makes people very resistant to any challenges. And there's a great book coming out by a social psychologist named Adam Alter, and I think it's called Irresistible, that really gets into our addiction to technology. I think it will dive into that a bit more.
I think the phones make us promises as though they were, I like to say, as though they were gifts from a genie, a benevolent genie.
Yeah.
More like a sort of kind of fairy godmother in the story. But like all those stories, it has a downside. You'll never have to be alone, but there's a problem if you never have to be alone, which is that you don't develop the capacity for solitude. You'll always be heard, but there's a problem if you can always be heard, which is that you don't listen to other people. You know, that you can always put yourself wherever you want to be, but there's a problem with that because you don't have to be present where you are. So, I mean, I think that all, you know, never alone, always be heard. You can be wherever you want to be. You can be in a tribe of one. Well, you know, I study people who text in church and synagogue. It's kind of a specialty de la maison. You know, I kind of, and actually, it's very interesting why they do it. They do it, they tell me, because they do it in the parts of the ceremony or the service when it comes to the boring bits. And everyone knows, I mean, I'm just struck by this atmosphere. I mean, in a service in a place like this, there are boring bits. But why don't we want to text or go to our phones when we're in a service? It's because we want to be part of a community where in a funeral, in particular, I've been studying texting in funerals. Because at a funeral, when those boring bits come, We don't text because part of why we're there is just to be part of a community, not in this tribe of one. And I think that's the that desire to just, you know, to never have those boring bits, to never be willing to just be and be with each other, bored but together, is one of the things that our phones bring us, because there always is stimulation, there always is that.
I'm reminded of the father that you spoke with, who is ashamed of himself that he's had bath time with his first couple kids,
yeah,
and loved it and spent, you know, really was, yeah, involved. By the time of the youngest child,
right,
when he had a cell phone, he couldn't stand doing the bath time with the child because it was,
right,
boring.
And he just sat on the, he put down the toilet, he made sure that his little girl was safe in the bathtub, it was not too hot and the water wasn't too high. He just put down the toilet and he sat on the toilet and he took out his phone and he did his mail.
Yeah, so that child is having a different experience. I want to talk more about kids, because it's just alarming that, you know, they just they're afraid of talking to each other. But it's not just kids, it's adults. You had mothers say to you, well, we like to text when there's a problem, text each other, because,
right,
we'll work it out through text, we'll discipline through text, because then there's no chance of a big emotional outcry.
Yes. So one of the reasons we text, and I think this is what complicates the story of addiction and what complicates the story of collective addiction, is really what we get out of using our phones for conversation. So Robin is referring to all the families I studied that want to do their family fights on GChat or some kind of chat program or texting. And essentially, it's so that you can sanitize them and not have all that terrible emotion during the fight, because you sort of edit your side of the story and you put it out there so you feel as though you've said it exactly the way you want to say it, and then the person on the other side can have a chance to take a deep breath and also put it out. And on one side, it seems to make sense. And it's like, okay, so everybody's saying what their full story and everybody's being heard. But people become terribly afraid of the messiness of human emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of what we're fleeing, is the sense of the messiness of human emotion and of our own... It's why so many mothers tell me they want their children to talk to Siri, to vent to Siri, that it's a good thing that their children, and because now there's going to be more than Siri, there's going to be sort of Siri plus, you know, to talk to robotic companions that are a lot smarter than Siri. And I will just say to all the parents here who are tempted by robotic companions, because your child will vent to them and feel freer to talk without any judgment, which is a big reason why mothers give me why they think it's a good idea for a child to have a robotic companion, is that the experience of a child saying, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you to a parent, you know, and here's why, and then having the parent, you know, say, well, that's interesting, I can, you know, talk to them about it and say, well, now it's dinner time. That experience of an explosion of feelings and seeing that you haven't destroyed the parent is one of the most important emotional experiences of childhood, that you can have your feelings and they don't destroy. Mm-hmm. And you take that away if you say, oh, you're having some feelings, you vent, go to the robot. Mm. That reinforces a child's every fear that what they have inside of them is so toxic that that their parent prefers they vent to the robot. Mm.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And this is like, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, do you like the play?
So good. This is fascinating.
Well, and we've got so many different storylines going here, but one of them is this idea that when you are on technology, and especially in the social media, you're not being your authentic self. We all know that. We try to have the best words to, you know, make ourselves clever, right, or, you know, if I'm going to send out this tweet, it can't be so dull, because look at that, I look so dull. And young people are just completely inventing another self when they're on social media. So you're all about finding your authentic self.
That's right.
We talked a little bit about the physical. Can we just talk a little more about that? I am dressed like a Sufi today, so I can do some of the demonstrations that you probably can't.
Oh.
But give us some more of the open, the physicality that helps us open and find our authentic selves.
I think the general idea is that when we expand, we feel more powerful. And this is true across the animal kingdom. I mean, there have been studies in at least 36 different cultures, including cultures where the researcher Jessica Tracy had to hike in and meet people who had never encountered outsiders. And what she found was that everywhere, when people felt powerful and confident, they expanded, right? So when they win first place, when they cross the finish line, they throw their arms up in the air and they lift their chin and they smile. And that's true everywhere. She has not found any places where that's an exception. Although, you know, if you look at body language in situations where people are giving more thought to it, that's where you see the cultural overlays. But the spontaneous reaction to expand when we feel powerful is a cultural universal to the same extent as smiling and happiness are linked.
So when guys go like this and they sit back like that,
yeah,
that's a powerful, powerful pose.
It is a powerful pose. I mean, that's an alpha primate pose, yeah. Right? But interestingly, we're getting a little bit off track, but I think this is going to be relevant. Girls, when you look at girls around middle school, I mean, so it's not just about what you're signaling to other people when you do this. And in fact, I tell people, when you're in an interaction, you shouldn't be acting like an alpha primate because you're not challenging people to a duel. You're trying to
have don't manspread.
Yeah, so I say
manspread.
No,
that's
no
manspreading,
right? No manspreading.
Have you seen manspreads? Like
yeah.
On the T?
Especially the New York City public transportation.
Yeah.
It has the whole no
don't
manspreading. But what I see when my son hit middle school, he just started high school. I noticed that his friends who were girls who were vibrant and throwing their arms up in the air when they ran around and doing cartwheels and all of a sudden stopped doing that. And they start doing this and pulling their sleeves over their hands and making themselves teeny tiny little fragile dolls and hiding, and they're shrinking violets. And I thought, what is going on? Because the boys weren't doing this. Now, I'm not saying that no boys do this, but there was certainly something gendered, and we know that body language is gendered. Is it learned or is it innate? I mean, a lot of people will say to me, no, it's innate, because when girls get breasts, they want to cover them. Like, well, when boys develop their parts, they don't necessarily want to go around covering them, so I'm not sure that I buy that argument. What we found in some of our work with 4-year-olds and 6-year-olds is that you can see them learning these associations. So we have them look at pictures of wooden dolls, like the doll on the cover of the book, in either expansive or contractive postures. There's always one expansive, one contractive. And we just say to these kids, point to the boy, point to the girl. And they fly through this task. By age 4, 75% show a bias toward expansiveness equals boy. By age 6, it's 85%. And I think more alarming, at age 4, only 13% have a perfect score. And by perfect, I mean that for all the 16 pairs, they thought the expansive one was a boy. By age 6, nearly half of them have a perfect score. They are learning this. We are not showing them images. We are tethering expansiveness to masculinity in many ways, not just physically, but about sharing ideas, speaking up, you know, having opinions, taking up some space in the world. And we need to do a better job of teaching girls that they're allowed to carry themselves unapologetically with pride and power and poise, you know, that it doesn't make them into boys. Mm-hmm. I think that we have to sort of, tease apart this gender and expansiveness thing. So I think that you get some meta stuff going on when it comes to gender and phones.
Well, also, I should say that some of my early work, I sort of have, I have a critique now of life with smartphones and our world of conversation. But my earlier work, I was on the cover of Wired magazine for very positive work. I was the sort of cyber diva for very positive style work about the impact of the internet on issues such as this.
Yeah.
Because the research on how women behave online is that finally, in my research, women would say, When I go online and I'm in a discussion room online, I am liberated from the tyranny of my high-pitched voice. That is the kind of thing that people said. I'm liberated from the tyranny of my body, and I am liberated from the tyranny of my high-pitched voice. And I forget the exact statistic, but it showed up in studies of online chat rooms that men think that those people who identify themselves as women, whether or not they're women online, you couldn't tell, but if you identify yourself as a woman online, if women take up 15% of the conversation, men think they're taking up over half of the conversation.
Well, I was just going to say, what happened when, you know, if they first felt liberated by it? We now have women like the local animator, and her name escapes me, who's been calling for more female superheroes, who's been clobbered online. I mean, we have women being crushed online now.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's why the story, that's why it's very important to, you know, to talk about how to make this technology, how to redesign this technology so it's good for us, rather than say technology is bad. Because it's really how you use it and what you make of it, as opposed to the technology just has these effects. For example, your phone doesn't have to, let me give a simple example. Right now, your phone allows you to text in the car. And actually, I have a house on the Cape, and if you drive out, you see a thing that says if you're under 18, or maybe if you're under 21, you lose your license if you text. But if you're over 21, you get a fine. It's like under 18, you lose your license. Over 18, you get a fine if you text. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Yeah. And when I pull out of the MIT parking lot, everybody is texting. It's like that's when the MIT professors decide they need to communicate with the world as they're driving. It's kind of crazy. So texting as we drive is something where your phone could know you're in the car and just not work then. And that is something that as consumers, it would make a lot of sense to demand from cell phone companies.
Here's the trouble, though. Don't we lie to ourselves? Because I am so nervous about this 16-year-old. I'm out of my mind. And then I'll see myself picking up my phone and starting to text in the car.
Well, your phone, well, that's what I'm saying, but as a consumer.
But in other words, I'm not sure. I might push for that, and now that you've planted the seed, you know, push for that. But there's a part of me that says, but there's an emergency.
There's an emergency.
There's never an emergency.
There may be an emergency, and in an emergency,
you pull over.
You would have to press a button that said, I am now in. I mean, it would make you do something.
Yeah.
It would make you pull over and be in emergency mode, which is pulled over. Or it would make you do something to justify an emergency. Or you'd hit an emergency button. I mean, we could design something special, but you would have to take a step to say, I am now in an emergency. And I think this would be a very good first step. And I think as consumers, we should, you know, demand it the same way, you know, we demand other things that would improve the quality of our life, because the number of deaths is stunning from texting while driving.
I was just thinking about going back to this authenticity piece and how it fits in with this idea that I have about power and powerlessness and how it relates to presence. You'd asked about sort of what is authenticity. And the idea is that when we feel powerless, it activates what we call the behavioral inhibition system. So lots and lots of research on this. It shuts us down. We become less creative. We are very self-focused in a bad way. We're worried about what other people think of us as opposed to what they think, right? So rather than having a conversation and paying attention to what they think, we're thinking about what they think of us. We appraise situations that are challenging as threatening, not as opportunities. We just really shut down and we are unable to reveal who we are. One of my favorite quotes about power is from Robert Caro, Lyndon Johnson's biographer, the historian. He said in an interview with The Guardian, they said, so does power corrupt? Which everyone loves. They want to know the answer to this question. And he said, power does not necessarily corrupt, but power always reveals. And I think I certainly think that's more accurate, right? So it activates what we call the approach system. It makes us more risk-taking. It makes us more positive and optimistic and confident and all of these things that allow us to be who we are. The interesting, though, twist here is getting back to sort of away a bit from the phone and more to, say, commenting or tweeting or using a pseudonym. You see some really nasty behavior, right? And when I started to be the target of some of that, because anyone who has any kind of public profile is the target of some of that, my first reaction was to feel really hurt, and why do they hate me? To give them the power, to allow them to have the power to hurt me. And I'm not saying that I'm done with that. It's really hard to avoid that completely. But now I think, oh, they're sitting at home feeling totally powerless. They're not, these are not people sitting at home feeling really good about themselves and powerful, and that's why they're writing nasty comments to you, yeah, using a pseudonym. They're doing it because they're sitting there feeling powerless, like they have no influence, and this is a way to get some kind of rise out of somebody. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that is a way, I mean, it's another way in which we are not presenting our most authentic selves. I don't think that, maybe I'm still super naive, but I don't think that those people who are trolling in that nasty way really see that as their core authentic self. Yeah. I think that's not really who they want to be.
No, I don't. I absolutely agree. I'm just saying that they stop the conversation. I mean, you're talking about,
right.
And they and by the way, NPR has just decided to remove all comments. There's no more public space there where people share a conversation because they're just not worth it anymore. Mm-hmm. They get taken over by trolls and. So that's their power, is that they in effect end up stopping conversation.
That's right.
And I want to ask, because you, as you said, it's not about getting rid of technology. It's here.
That's such a shame. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's just to
oh, to stop in the conversation.
To
I
mark
know.
That moment. I mean, I think that really we do best when we say who we are, take responsibility for our words, and hold ourselves accountable for them. And I think we took a bad turn online when we said, oh, but this will be different, this will be empowering, everybody will just feel free to be and just express, and didn't use, I like to say technology makes us forget what we know about life. And I think this is an area in the political sphere where what we know about life is that when you hold people accountable for what they're thinking and what they're saying, they think about it and do best. So I think it's very, I actually feel very sad.
When I have, and I rarely get any kind of negative feedback.
Oh.
Oh my God, like all the time. And I always engage, always.
Right.
It doesn't matter how crass it is, always. And always, every single time, whether it's a comment on the webpage or it's a tweet or it's an email or a letter, always, 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 the person writes back. I can't stress enough, always, and this is hundreds of times over a lot of time, over many years, always the person writes back and says, oh my God, I didn't realize how that looked. Or, thank you so much, because I didn't mean it to sound like that, but I wanted, you know, thank you for responding
right.
Every single time.
Right.
So I agree with you. I think if people were held to using their name, I mean, and I've had some vicious, vicious trolling people.
Right.
It doesn't matter. I mean, they may still say, well, I still think that you're this or that or the other thing, but thank you. And, you know, it is about the human interaction. It's about
right.
The humanity. How do we get to, now, can I give away what you told us in the green room, that you're like on some sort
oh,
of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
Amy's like trying to go cold turkey.
Not completely, but yeah, 95%, I'd say, reduction in...
Twitter rehab.
And Facebook, yeah.
Facebook, too.
Yeah, and any yeah. news related to my
because
I just in the last month have been targeted by a lot of nastiness.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of nastiness going on in my field in general, but it's been particularly
what
bad.
Nastiness is going on in your field?
We're having a bit of a methods crisis, and in other fields that have sort of gone through this, they don't necessarily see it as a crisis; they see it as an evolution. But in my field, oh my gosh, we're imploding, and there are a lot of ad hominem attacks about research and that are disproportionately against women and by men.
Wait, are people saying, oh, this sounds like a new Fox show. We could.
Oh, I don't.
So, are people saying, for instance, you know, the idea of physicality? I mean, how
yeah.
The idea of the physicality.
Well, there's been
is not valid.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into too much detail because of my celibacy
it's
right now.
It's just us.
But right, it's just us, and all of your phones where you can look it up right now. But
right now.
It's oh, wow. I mean, I think if you have a positive message as a social scientist, that makes you a target. I don't know the exact psychology of that, even as a psychologist, but it seems to bug some people. Mm-hmm. I do think if you experience some success outside of academia, it makes you a target. Mm-hmm. I think probably if you're a woman, it makes you a target. So, you know, I've had a couple of non-anonymous trolls targeting me for a couple of years, a year and a half. It's been pretty unpleasant. I've learned to not read that stuff, and then it sort of exploded about a month ago, and I'm not going to go into the details.
Sure.
But I decided, being totally honest, had kind of a breakdown. I mean, it was really awful, and I had such a positive bunch of Twitter followers, and I feel like my Twitter followers and my Facebook people are really nice, but all of a sudden social media became something not nice, and you know, it was like I was getting emails from people who are friends who were like, oh God, I'm so sorry this is happening, as if somebody in my family had died. Like, that's the reaction, the fact that I was getting attacked on social media, some people interpreted it as the end of the world. So I had to actually tell my friends, please stop catastrophizing, because it really sends my heart rate through the roof. And I had to really pull myself completely away from reading any of the coverage, because it was just the same thing again and again. Lots of wrong information, just people trying to, you know, stir something up that really wasn't there. So I ended up taking like a week away. I actually went to the middle of the country in Tennessee and to this really, really interesting retreat and on my own, and really tried to, I mean, they were like watching me to take my phone away from me. You know, I felt like, well, I still have to do work. But I spent about a week really not on my phone. And I have to say, it was painfully anxiety-producing at moments to not be able to check, to see what was going on, to think something horrible might have happened and I won't be able to put that fire out. But, you know, I came home with some really good sort of rules, things like, you know, no phones in the bed. I know this seems like such a small thing, but no phones in the bed.
Big thing.
And this morning we actually agreed no phones in the bedroom. Right? We can have an old-fashioned alarm clock. We don't actually need our phone to wake us up in the morning. So, you know, no explosions
actually,
of bad news in the morning.
This is one of my top tips to families, that you should have a sort of meeting all together, and everybody in the family gets an old-fashioned alarm clock. Because one of the biggest sleep disruptors for teenagers, for kids, is that kids go to bed with their, I mean, not to even mention grown-ups and, you know, intimacy, but teens, kids go to bed saying, this is my alarm clock, and when they wake up in the middle of the night, they
texts them at 1 a.m, you can get something on your phone bill, which I have, which will tell you.
Yeah.
If there's a text at 1,
people aren't sleeping, and they're getting, they're not,
you know, I gotta say, couldn't you just stay here forever? And
are
just,
we at the end?
But we're gonna give people an opportunity to ask questions, right? So I just want to, if you don't mind, because I don't know if I'm gonna see Amy soon afterwards. How many people here remember Channel 7 in the mid '80s? Oh, thank God! I anchored at Channel 7 in the mid '80s, and it was. There were so many attacks on me. It was the most astonishing thing. So I was on the cover of the Herald 5 times. I mean, these TV critics were so out to get me because I had the nerve. I was at the Today Show, and I came back, and I anchored here, and there was all these questions of money, and Tom Ellis got stolen from Channel 5. Some of you remember. I will pay you to forget. it was horrible. It was so vicious. It was pre-social media. I can't imagine what it would have been like with social media, but it was so vicious that I was on the cover of the Herald five different times. One time, half the front cover had big block letters that said, Robin's body still not found, and underneath was a picture of me. And my friends thought I had died. And what they had cleverly done in another attack on me was there was a headline from a case here about the Tufts professor who was having an affair with Robin Benedict, who was a young Tufts student and maybe a call girl. And she had been murdered, her body had disappeared. And it was the ongoing trial. So it said, Robin's body still not found. And then the picture of me said in little tiny print underneath it, Robin Young at last night's Emmy Awards or something like that. You know what? Just F them. You are so fantastic.
Thank you.
You are so fantastic. Do not. Do not. Do not let that. And yet I know, I can't imagine having gone through what I went through, what it would be like with social media.
Thank you.
So you know what you should do? You know what you should do. We're going to take questions. People want to ask questions. Line up here. Can we do the starfish? Can we do the starfish? Everybody, starfish up. We're just going to do the starfish. You just go just, like that.
Right, you just cross the
like
finish
that.
Line.
Just
stretch
go
out for
like
a minute.
That.
Expand your chest. Breathe deeply.
Doesn't that feel good?
You know, feel the power. Feel the relaxation.
And it's for Amy.
Thank you.
Amy
Hutton
so and
much.
Sharon Kirkle.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Questions. Please line up at the microphone. We're going to hear some great questions now, and then we'll get some books signed. Please. And let's have a little quiet for the questions. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Jamie, and I'm wondering how you think this whole technology crisis, this antisocialness, because of the phones, is going to continue to play out like through future generations. Because I know that when I was younger, I was always reading and playing with like toys and friends. And now the kids I babysit who are 7, 10, all they want to do is be on their phones, and they can't imagine like being without them even when they're in the car together. And so I'm just wondering how you think that, like, when I'm raising my kids, if they'll be so obsessed with like advanced technology, or if it'll have regressed back as fashion trends seem to have done, what you think will happen with future generations and their technology.
I think that we're at a moment, I call it the kind of a silent spring moment, like Rachel Carson talked about when we first realized that technology was assaulting our environment. I think we realized that the technology, there's an assault on empathy now, and it's our own silent spring. And I know that even though it looks like we're on a curve in the wrong direction, I think that it takes kind of a moment like we're at now. The most recent statistic is that 89% of Americans interrupted their last conversation to look at their phone, and 82% say that it deteriorated their interaction. So I think we know, and here's Robin, you know, texting and knowing that it's not a good idea. So the question is, how long does a culture live with that kind of sense that we're doing something that kind of isn't right for us and our kids? And I think that my research shows that we're at a moment of possible inflection. And I think that what gives me hope is that I grew up with a mother who adored me, and she fed me thinking that it was the best things for me, stuff out of cans, because in the 60s, that's what you were told. So there was like fruit bits.
Right. In syrup.
In syrup. And one of the fruits was a maraschino cherry.
Yeah.
And I have a daughter, and if I had fed her some of my food items from my childhood, it could have either been a Mad Men retrospective, or I would have been considered an abusive mother.
So you're hoping it can change.
So I'm saying it can change. I mean, how did we decide that we were going to eat differently? And I think that's the kind of moment we're at now. So I know it doesn't look great, but I think that your children will profit from your mentorship.
Can I add one yeah. more sort of superficial way in which that might change? So my nephew, who's really young, asked my sister-in-law, who showed him a camera, that's not a camera. And she said, why not? And he goes, where's the phone? and then another guy said to me that his daughter kept trying to swipe this picture frame. You know, and another guy said, you know, his son had drawn something in pencil, and he said, delete it. And he goes, just erase it. And he goes, I want it deleted. You know, so here's what I'm hoping. The hipsters will decide pretty soon that, like, phones with cords are really cool. So I'm hoping that it becomes a fashion.
Yeah, like turntables.
So suddenly we're like, yeah, exactly.
Like turntables.
Like albums, right.
Thank you. We want to get as many questions in as we can, so we'll...
I love technology, but the etiquette hasn't caught up yet. Growing up, we had phone booths that had little doors so your conversations were private. Do you see design evolution in restaurants and whatnot, public places, where those type of private spaces might be available, or other issues that design might help make technology be more polite?
Well, it's really interesting, because I started thinking, so I'm spending the year at the School of Public Health, just seems like an interesting place to be. You know, similar questions, but different populations. And, you know, of course, we're always thinking about smoking and diet, and you think about restaurants designed so that, you know, you can't smoke inside. I mean, obviously rules, but also places where you can smoke. And you see places starting to say no cell phones. I wonder if we'll see more and more of that. I think we won't see it until we see that there's a public health cost to being in a space where everybody's on their cell phones. So maybe what we first have to demonstrate that there's a large-scale sort of health
cost.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. Health cost. And then maybe we'll see design issues.
I think it's happening. I think the health cost is happening. Yeah.
I think we need to document it, and you know, it needs to be empirical.
Okay, I'll tell you everything I'm feeling because I'm feeling it. Thank you. We'll get another question in.
The two presidential candidates.
Oh, no.
Thought we were going to get...
Sorry, I really don't want this to be political.
Go.
I'd like
go ahead.
Science answer. The male candidate seems to be highly insecure. Do some people read him as strong because of the physicality?
Do some people... I didn't miss the last part.
Some people say they think he's strong. Is that because of his physical presence? Because the words seem very insecure to me, anyway.
Talk about the physicality of that debate.
Okay. Yes. Well, so I thought, frankly, just going back to the last debate, people always want me to tweet about the body language of during debates. I have to say, the lurking and the pacing to me came across as so nervous. It did, it's funny, everyone, or many people interpreted it as intentionally threatening. I don't think it was.
Didn't Jane Goodall comment on it as being, she
yes.
did, as being like ape-like.
It is ape-like, but I don't.
She did.
It appeared alpha, but I'll tell you what one of the giveaways was. The shallow breathing. Did you notice that? That is anxiety. I have been there. That was anxiety. I did not read that. Maybe it was an attempt to seem like an alpha, but I think there was a lot more nervousness. But let me answer it a different way, because I think getting away from body language, one of the things that we didn't get to talk about is that power and confidence and leadership are related to circulating levels of testosterone and cortisol. So the best leaders, so the people who are not only most likely to have power, but are rated well by the people who follow them, are relatively high on testosterone and relatively low on cortisol. That's true for women and men. Now, that's because testosterone is related to assertiveness and confidence and a desire to take on challenges. Cortisol is linked to anxiety and stress and defensiveness. So if you have someone who's high on this one and low on this one, you have someone who can weather challenges and is not defensive, doesn't feel slighted easily. What I think you're seeing is a person who's high on T and C, right? So they're high on testosterone and cortisol. So that's what you get when you get a leader who has you've got this sort of assertiveness and desire to compete, but real stress reactiveness and anxiety and feeling easily threatened. So you get that kind of behavior. I don't read it at all as real confidence. I read it as sort of a smokescreen for insecurity.
It'll be interesting to watch on Wednesday. We'll keep that in mind when we watch. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we have one more, I think? And then that'll be it. That's good.
Much of your approach seems to focus on avoidant strategies. Would you think that perhaps on the other spectrum, at the other end, strategies that sort of not embrace, but tackle the issue head on and force people to be more mindful of what is going on. So rather than having the cell phone out of the room, you teach people to see, here's my phone, I see it, I have a cognitive response, and I think someone may be calling me, and now I'm anxious. Now I think about Facebook, and now I'm anxious. I think
be mindful.
Yes, it would be more, you could much more generalize the skill of teaching people to be mindful rather than
that's a great
focusing on one thing and putting it away.
I think that's a great question. I mean, basically, yes. Yes. I think we have to live with our phones, and, you know, saying that the only step that comes to mind is put it away during a conversation, if that's where it all ended, that would be, that would be a lapse of imagination. But I will say this, is that, and perhaps this will give you my general philosophy, and then I'd love to see how Amy responds to this philosophical question. The lead author on the study found that over the past 30 years, there'd been a 40% decline in empathy levels among college students, with most of the decline in the past 10 years, so that it was linked to devices. I had a chance to talk to her, Sarah Conrath, about how she felt after that work was done. It was published in the press, and it was very popular. And she said she got depressed. I mean, that's something that defined that. And she started writing empathy apps for the iPhone. In other words, games you could play on the phone to increase your empathy scores on a test you would take. And I think that's a very typical response. You want to use technology to help fix the thing that we fear technology has taken away from us. We want to make it better by using technology. And I just would say to you that my perspective is to increase our mindfulness so that we remember that we are the empathy app. That we, in talking to each other in mindful ways with presence, that is the empathy app. I would say that's my message.
Sir, that was a great place to end. I'd like to say just one way in which I have helped my son, I think, become more mindful about the effect of technology is he knows I study body language. He uses it in soccer games. You know, he expands before a penalty kick or something, and it helps him. And there's a lot of research on this. But what I've asked him to do is pay attention to when he starts to collapse. And I've noticed that it always happens when he's holding his phone. And so I see it. I instantly see when he goes, and I go, what happened? And he says, oh, I just posted this thing on Snapchat and nobody responded to it. You know, and then he'll go, maybe it's time to get off the phone for a while. Like, so it really, and he feels the difference. He's resistant, and he'll even say, I'm agitated because you're making me be away from it. But I'll get over it. And 10 minutes later, he's like, I feel a lot better.
I had my nephew the other day walk up to me with his Xbox and say, take it.
Wow.
Yeah, take it. Listen, how fantastic are they? Wow. Sherry Turkle, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Presence, Reclaiming Your Presence. The books will be back there. They will be back there. Thank you so much. This was the best of the Book Fest. Thank you.